Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. Well, tonight we have a very, very special guest. His name is Ed Griffin, and I've known Ed for, well, over 44 years, since he came to my house in December of 1962 and gave a talk. And he's always been one of the leaders of the conservative movement, and I've enjoyed having him on a guest here on my programs. Through the years, he's made a number of outstanding DVDs and videos and audio tape sets. But the other evening, how it was, I don't know, but somebody had sent me a video. It was called The Capitalist Conspiracy, and it was really a takeoff on something that Cleon Skousen has written many, many years ago, based upon a book written by Professor Carol Quigley. And, of course, back in 1966, that Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, hit the conservative movement like a tornado. And here, for the first time, was somebody who was on the inside, admitted to having had an opportunity to go through the secret records of a secret organization, the one that was directing American foreign policy. It was an amazing book, amazing because of what it told and what it exposed, even more amazing because of the fact that Professor Quigley, as brilliant as he was, had missed the entire point of so much of what he'd uncovered, because he never understood the spiritual forces that energized the people that he wrote about. But back in 1966, when we read this, and then subsequently when Cleon Skousen wrote his book, The Capitalist Conspiracy, we were beginning to at least get a peek behind this, by this veil that cloaks so much of what's going on. And so I thought it might be interesting if we just sort of reviewed that part of the history of the conservative movement and the thought process that really intrigued so many of us at that time, trying to understand why the American government and their foreign policy had consistently helped communism, had turned Eastern Europe over to the communists at the end of the Second World War, had facilitated the communist Chinese rise to power, the betrayal of our boys in Vietnam, and of course the no-win war in Korea. And with that as a background, Ed Griffin, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Stan. It's always a pleasure to be here and hear you give such a brilliant overview of the topic that we're going to cover on the subject of this, at least this topic, and you're talking about Professor Quigley in particular. I think you are undoubtedly the foremost expert on that topic.
Well, I think that your video is great because we get a chance to see these people that I've been talking about for years and you've been talking about, and you have pictures of them and you go into the background and how this whole thing fit together. So I'm going to let you sort of pick up this story and run with it.
Well, thank you, Stan. I really am not prepared in the way I like to be prepared for a topic. You know, I should have sat down and prepared a little bit of an outline, but I think I can splash around in this one, and it'll be okay. I'll start with your comments, because you made me flashback in memory to those years. I remember when I first became involved and aware. That was actually my first exposure to any of this was in 1959, if you can believe that. By 1960, I was pretty fired up and on a fast track to acquire as much information as I could. I thought I was pretty darn smart in those days, as I guess most of us do when we get a little bit of knowledge. And in the 1960s, I was a full-blown crusader. I was trying to warn people about the rise of communism.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Ed Griffin. All right, Ed, pick the story up from there.
Yes, well, I'm just saying, back in the 1960s, early and mid-1960s, I was running full bore as a crusader, trying to warn people about the threat of communism, not only around the world, but actually within our own borders. Communism was the big thing we worried about in those days. And it was by 1974, I had written my first book on the United Nations. And one of the things that shocked me and led me to write that book was the very strong communist influence in the creation of the United Nations. The fact that the UN was largely the product of the United States government, the State Department in particular. I think it was the post-war foreign policy planning division in the State Department. And it turns out that that was under the direction of Alger Hiss and a lot of other hidden communist agents who were American citizens, but their loyalty was to the Soviet Union. And when I was learning all these things, I was just on fire. Why didn't I learn about this before? How come I have to research to find these things out? How come it's not in the press? How come nobody else knows about it? And worse, seems nobody cares about it. And so the reason I'm telling this part of the story is that in those days, I was really focused on the communist side of this problem. And I realized that there was a lot of overlapping between communist agents and people who were apparently not members of the Communist Party. And in fact, you would expect them to be anti-communist because they were very wealthy people. And the assumption that I had in those days, and I think the assumption that many people still have, is that if you're wealthy, that makes you a capitalist, that they two somehow must go together. I didn't realize, naive that I was, didn't realize that some of the wealthiest people in the world were not capitalists at all, but were socialists or collectivists. But anyway, I wasn't aware of that at the time. So the point of all this is that it gradually is an educational process that continues today, Stan. Each year that goes by, I learn a little bit more pieces of the puzzle go together, and I realize now that there are two major branches of collectivism out there. One of them, for the sake of finding a single word that covers it, let's call it the Leninist branch. Because even though at one time in history they called themselves communists, they really were ready to abandon that title because they really were Leninists. When we had the so-called demise of communism, all these people did was to take the hats off of their heads that said communist, and they put new hats on that said social democrats. But they were the same heads underneath the hats.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we bring our other stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed Griffin is our guest this evening, and he's reminiscing, as I sometimes do, about what was happening back in the 1950s, 1960s, even into the 1970s, as so many people within the conservative movement were anti-communist, and we thought the enemy was communism, but there were a lot of things that just didn't make sense. And as Ed has been saying, what was really so strange was that there seemed to be so many people who were fabulously wealthy who were supporting communism, and yet obviously they were not communist. And Ed was talking about the formation of the United Nations, and the man who wrote the United Nations Charter was Edward Griffin, was Alger Hiss.
And yet, don't get me mixed up with Alger.
And yet, of course, when Alger Hiss was on trial, I mean, the people who testified as character witnesses for him, people like Dean Acheson and John Foster Dulles and many of the leaders of the country, the financial and political leaders of the country. So none of this made sense. And Ed and I and many others were trying to, in our own mind, understand what was going on. You pick up the story.
Yes. Well, I look back on all that now, Stan, and I realize that, I don't know about you, but I was probably at the high school level of my education because I was just learning basics, and I hadn't realized at that time that there were two branches of collectivism out there in the world, and we were totally focused on that Leninist branch. And right under our noses, representing the forces that we identified with, the United States government and the British and all the Western world who were supposedly aligned against communism, we didn't look carefully there to realize that there was another group that was dominant there that believed essentially the same things as the Leninists, They were anti-communist, all right, but not because they opposed the Leninists in their ideology, but because they opposed them for competitive reasons. They both wanted to rule the world, therefore they fought for dominance in that struggle. But both groups, I eventually learned, were interested in a one-world government based on the model of collectivism. And they were just fighting over to who was going to run that world, or at least who was going to be the most dominant within it. And then along comes your friend, Professor Quigley, and there was the key that really opened up the door and allowed us to look inside this other group. And for lack of another name, I've decided to call it the Rhodesians. So we've got the Leninists on one side and the Rhodesians on the other. And the reason I chose the word Rhodesians, as you know, is because this whole other group, this other so-called anti-communist group of collectivists, was really the outgrowth of a secret society that was created by Cecil Rhodes. And it has a continuity that comes right down from that date to the present. So in a nutshell, that's how my overview is. I'm still learning more about the Rhodesians, and it's amazing to me that they were very active in the 60s and 70s, to be sure. And here I was right in the middle of their camp, and I didn't even see it.
Well, I think that we were also very, very blind. We recognized, for instance, the great tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, were actually funding so much of the communist movement here in the United States. And we're funding so much of the socialist movement here in the United States. And then we begin to study the financing of communism from its inception, and specifically with the work of Professor Anthony Sutton. And we find out that, I mean, from the very beginning, American corporations and American banks were actually financing the communist movement. And they had, going back to 1918, well, this just began to be so confusing. Why would those people be funding communism that was supposedly dedicated to the destruction of their very existence?
Right. Well, my answer to that question is that the different groups within that larger group probably had different motives, but there are not too many of them. One, of course, in the beginning, those people that were sending money into Russia to finance the Bolshevik Revolution wanted to make sure that they had influence in the new government, no matter who won. They were actually financing all of the revolutionary groups, and they were prepared to, you know, be very close with whichever one won, which happened to be the Bolsheviks. And I think that to some extent they had one of their motives was to have access to the great mineral and natural resources of the Soviet Union, which they did. They literally picked that nation clean. They made huge profits with the deals they struck with the new government. So part of it was profit-seeking. The other part is that these people helped communism not because they want communism, because they couldn't care less. It's because what they want is collectivism. They don't care what kind of collectivism it is. It could be communism. It could be fascism. As a matter of fact, you'll find that some of these people were very active in supporting and financing the Nazi regime for the same reason. Nazis, the fascists, are the same as the communists when it comes to ideology. And here again, they fight against each other for dominance, see who's going to control the territory, who's going to control the world. But they both believe exactly the same thing. They're going to do the same thing with the world when they take charge.
Well, I think the most interesting thing was eventually we began to realize that these people were financing the right and the left. They were organizing anti-communist organizations. Yeah. I mean, they were funding the Democrats and the Republicans. And they wanted this controversy here in America, as we had some people, of course, the left was calling everybody on the right, you know, fanatical. They were McCarthyites. They saw communists under every bed. And the trouble was there were many people who were dedicated communists working in government, but they were not the major force that was, you know, creating all the problems. And as Professor Quigley said there in the end of that chapter, where from page 950, I've forgotten about 965, somewhere in there. Anyway, the end of that chapter, I mean, the problem was that a lot of these people had thought that there were communists at Harvard. There were communists in the New York Times. There were communists working in our State Department, and it was never the communists. It was always this Anglo-American establishment. He sort of, you know, excused what they'd done as being sort of misguided idealists.
Yes, well, I sometimes don't think they're misguided idealists at all.
I don't think so either, but that was his explanation.
Yes, but you've touched on a very important point, and that was the third thing I was leading to before, as to why we have this apparent division in this conflict, is because the Rhodesians are very brilliant. They want to convert the world, and let's talk about the United States. That's where we are. They want to convert the United States to a totalitarian system on the model of collectivism, with themselves in control. That's really their goal. It's not just my saying that. They've written about it. Professor Quigley described it. We know that this is their goal, and they have said long ago that the best way to get the American people to give up their freedoms and to give up their traditions and their judicial systems and their concept of justice and so forth is to scare the heck out of them with wars or threats of war or terrible calamities, so that the only thing they're concerned about is survival. If you can get the American people concerned totally about national security or survival in a global war of some kind, then they will gladly give up all of these things, and that is their strategy. And so in order to do that, you have to have a credible enemy. And, of course, there are real enemies out there, but sometimes they're not frightening enough. And so the Rhodesians have developed the technique, and they've been masters at it, of actually helping to build up the specter of a horrible and credible enemy, so that this will stampede the American people into blindly accepting any loss of their liberties and their rights as necessary in order to protect themselves against this dreaded enemy. And so there, in a nutshell, is the strategy. And it's so simple, but it's so bizarre that most people have trouble believing that it's true.
And I really think, of course, we can't really understand what's going on today unless we understand what happened during the Vietnam War era. Here, starting in 62 up to about 74. Certainly we anti-communists felt we had to defeat communism. Communism was going to take over Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and Malaysia and then Australia and New Zealand, and soon they'd be on the streets of San Francisco. At least that's what we believed. And that is what we were led to believe, and we were fighting communism. And, of course, the people on the left, they were opposing the Vietnam War. And they said, that it was a senseless war, and there were the Jane Fondas of this world who really wanted the communists to win, and there were some people who wanted the communists to win. And, of course, certainly, how could anybody support them? And I certainly couldn't support them, and I don't to this day. They had betrayed America. But, on the other hand, was the war right? And, of course, when you follow it along, you found out we never tried to win the war. And then Professor Sutton comes along and, in the early 70s, and he gives a talk before the Republican convention there in 1972, pointing that we're financing the Russians, who are financing the North Vietnamese, who are financing the Viet Cong, who are supplying the weapons that are killing our boys. And then we get hold of the rules of engagement. We found out our men weren't allowed to win the war.
Of course, because remember a moment ago I said that in order to stampede the American people into this policy, you've got to have a credible enemy. Well, if you defeat the enemy, then you don't have a credible enemy anymore.
Well,
so one of the things you have to have is an enemy, and the second thing you have to have is to make sure that he continues.
And, of course, you can't understand really what's going on in the Middle East today unless you understand that. I mean, our boys are fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan. Who's funding the Taliban? Why, of course, the Pakistani intelligence agency. They're funding them, they're training them, they're there. Of course, that's their refuge. We can't go in and get them in Pakistan. Well, who's funding the Pakistani intelligence? Well, the Pakistani government. And who's funding the Pakistani government? Why, your tax money, ladies and gentlemen. And why don't we simply follow the Taliban into Pakistan and take them out? Oh, we couldn't do that. Why, we'd topple that good government that supports us. And it's Vietnam all over again.
And we wouldn't have a credible enemy.
We wouldn't have a credible enemy. We'll be back in just a moment with Ed Griffin. Okay, Ed, go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, I don't know. It sounds to me like we sort of ran ahead here, Stan, and came almost to the end of the story.
Oh, well, you take us back to the beginning, because we really need to understand who these people are and how they fit together.
Hmm.
I mean, certainly, name of Schiff and the name, certainly, of the people within the banking movement who were really back there at the very beginning of all this, and how that all began to fit together. That was what you brought out so well in your book,
in
your video.
Well, thank you, Stan. It's a fascinating story, and fortunately, it's a well-documented story. When you deal with things like this, which are incredible, literally meaning unbelievable, you better make sure that you've got documentation to prove it. Of course, to some people, it doesn't make any difference how much documentation you have. They don't believe it anyway, because they don't want to believe it. But I can relate to that. I think I've been there in several points in my life.
We all have.
Yeah, you had to kind of boot yourself to say, oh, well, once I don't, this is a bunch of garbage, but let me take a look at it anyway. And then halfway through it, sometimes you say, what do you know? How about this? But anyway, I don't mean to be too hard on people, because it's human nature. The point I'm trying to make is that this story is well documented, and it's documented in the papers and in the books of the people themselves who have lived it, and whom we would consider to be our opponents in all this. They're pretty proud about it. They of course don't describe themselves as conspirators. They don't, you know, they always defend what they're doing in terms of, well, this is for the benefit of society, and we have to do this because we don't want to have the world blown up in atomic holocaust and so forth. But having justified why they say they're doing it, then they go pretty straightforward and tell you how they do it and how they use deception and why they use deception and why that's good that they use deception and how great they are because they use deception and all of that. They're pretty clear about all of that. And the story really begins with, I think, you could go back further, but I think it really begins with the formation of the secret society created by Cecil Rhodes upon his death. I'm sure your listeners, Stan, are very well informed of this, and they're very sophisticated. But for those few that might be stumbling across our path, Cecil Rhodes was one of the wealthiest men of the world. He had made a fabulous fortune in South Africa. He'd gotten pretty much a monopoly on the diamond fields and the gold fields and so forth. One of the wealthiest men of the world. And that part is known, and people know that, well, there's a Rhodes scholarship that was set up upon his death in his will, and that's pretty well known, and that's about it. And people think of him as just a kindly old philanthropist that set up a scholarship to help young men, and I guess women too now, have a good education. Well, it's much bigger than that. We find out that Rhodes actually created seven wills, and the other wills were devoted to funding what he called a secret society. These are his words. He wanted to create a secret movement that would literally dominate the world. And in the beginning, and by the way, he spent practically all of his vast fortune to the funding and perpetuation of this secret society. And according to Professor Quigley in his book, A Tragedy in Hope, he says very clearly that this organization has continued through the years and is very much alive and functional today. And
I want you to hold that thought. We're just going to bring our stations back on board. We'll be right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is G. Edward Griffin, and he's really talking about the Rhodesian, as he refers to them. And he says that they are really the essence of so much of what's going on. And he talks about Cecil Rhodes' desire to create a secret society, which he talked about in the first five of his seven wills. And this is historical. We never hear about it today because we're not supposed to believe their secret societies. But if you go back and read about Rhodes' first seven wills, the first five of them talked about creating a secret society. He wrote a Confession of Faith, where he talks about a secret society. We actually have a copy of the original thing that he actually looked like he typed it himself. It's so poorly done, and we'll be glad to send that to one of our listeners who would like to see it. So you pick up the story there.
Yes, I might add, Stan, I don't. I have not seen that, so would you please put me on your list?
Well, certainly we'll send you a copy of The Confession of Faith. Be glad to.
I would like to see that. I have copies off the Internet of some of his handwritten notes where he's talked about the necessity of... at one point he said that he was a member of the Masonic Lodges, and he kind of scoffed at that. He said, I've never seen... These are my words now, but I'm paraphrasing him. He says, I've never seen such a waste of human effort. They have all these secret hand clasps and secret meetings. And he said, it's all wonderful, but it doesn't go anywhere. There's no purpose to it, he said. And then he said, it dawned on me, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do something like that where we really had a worthwhile goal in mind, like taking over the world?
Right.
And this is in his handwritten notes, so I do have that in my file. Basically, that was his plan, is to, in the beginning, the goal was to spread the British lifestyle, the British concept of government throughout the world, because his belief was that that was the highest form of civilization yet achieved by man, and he felt that they were the inheritors of this wonderful tradition, and therefore it was their obligation to see that the rest of the world benefited by it. You see, that's the self-serving rationale that you always find behind collectivism. Collectivists always believe that they are better or smarter than the rest of the world. It's not their fault. It's just their good fortune, the collectivists. It's our good fortune to be in this wonderful position. We have an education. We have the knowledge. We have the wisdom. And so it's our obligation to rule the world for the benefit of the masses who don't have that. And somebody has to do it, so I guess we are the ones who are going to do it. That's pretty much the message that Cecil Rhodes carried to his followers. And he applied his vast wealth to create an organization to perpetuate that concept. Well, it didn't take long after his death before they realized that they weren't going to perpetuate the British Empire throughout the world. And it over a period of, I'm guessing now, maybe 30 or 40 years, that goal changed into the goal of world government based on the model of collectivism, and not necessarily centered in Great Britain, although they continued to believe that that would be a dominant center, but it would be in the United Nations, and it would be a true international structure, but everything else would be the same. They would still rule it from behind the scenes and that sort of thing. And that's about the time that the gravity, as I see it, shifted from London to New York. And that's about the time that J.P. Morgan and company came on board as part of the secret society, and they established a branch of it in the United States, which was called the Council on Foreign Relations. And Morgan dominated it in the beginning, and then a few more years pass by, Morgan is gone, and now we see the Rockefellers as the dominant force in that structure. So that's how it all evolved, from Rhodes to others, but Morgan was the dominant one in the United States, and now, of course, I believe that it's clearly the Rockefeller dynasty that runs the show. And the Council on Foreign Relations is that hidden government in America. It's an organization of about 4,000 people, give or take. They describe themselves as being a semi-secret organization, which is a convenient way of explaining the fact that they don't tell you anything. You're not allowed to go to their meetings unless you're invited. You're not allowed to talk about conferences that are held and so forth. But they appear to the general public as being just kind of a think tank, doing high-level thinking and planning for the benefit of the United States. But in reality, their goal is to shift the United States into world government based on the model of collectivism.
And they're certainly doing a pretty good job, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're far along in that task, and they're very arrogant and confident now that they're going to wrap the whole thing up probably in the next couple of years.
Of course, they're behind the North American Union. They're behind the European Union, the African Union, the South American Union, the Asian Union that's developing similar trading blocks, and the Arab countries. And then when they get them all in place, it'll be a very short step to unite them all into a one world government with a new world religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ed Griffin. We're talking about the capitalist conspiracy. The capitalist conspiracy. It's an excellent video which Ed has put out, and I was enthralled with it. Somebody had sent me a copy, and I don't know whether it was somebody from his office or somebody else, and as I watched this, it brought back so many memories of the evolution of thought and to understand who the people were who, back in the early part of the last century, were certainly involved in this whole concept. So you pick up the story there.
Well, I think what we're doing here, Stan, is going back over the story a couple of different times like a rake, and each time we go through it, we pick up some more some facts. I don't know where to go back on this again. The Council on Foreign Relations, of course, is a critical focal point for any understanding of what's happening in the world.
Well, how about the tie into international finance? Because, of course, this is where the power is. If you have the money, why, you can shape the events.
Well, yes, I think that now you're getting very close to my heart, because one of the subcategories of this larger picture is the financial structures of the world and the money systems of the world, and I've spent more time researching that than most of the other elements, so I know a little bit about that. And the one thing you cannot help but notice is, from the very beginning, the key players in the Rhodesian side of this structure have always been fabulously wealthy people. All starting with Cecil Rhodes himself, and of course he surrounded himself with people like Lord Rothschild as part of this structure. Now here we've got another huge bag of money, and also we're involved in the banking system the minute you bring Rothschild into it. And you find that all of the key figures at the Bank of England were part of this. And then you jump over the pond to the United States, and lo and behold, there you are with J.P. Morgan. And Morgan and Rockefeller and their business associates collude together to create the Federal Reserve System in 1913. And now you see that same influence penetrating into the monetary system of the United States. And no matter where you go, in whatever country you want to chase this structure down, you find that the people at the very pinnacle of control are also the ones who are astride the banking and the monetary systems of that country. So you have to be a kind of an idiot not to figure out that money has something to do with this. Just as an aside, it seems...
Hold that thought for just a minute as we bring our stations right back here.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is G. Edward Griffin. And before we go on, Ed, I'd like you to give you an opportunity to get out your website and how people can get in touch with you and your organization.
Well, thanks, Stan. Yes, I've got a couple of organizations. The commercial site that we have is where we offer books and videos and audio recordings for sale. And we call that the Reality Zone. And the website is pretty simple, easy to remember. It's realityzone.com. Realityzone.com. But the other site is where I spend most of my time, and that is an organizational site. We have a group called Freedom Force International. And the purpose of Freedom Force International is to try and solve some of the problems that we're talking about. It doesn't do much good to know all of these things if you can't do anything about it. And so the focus of Freedom Force is to try and mobilize people all over the world. We now have members in 35 countries, have the same problem all over the world. And we're trying to mobilize people and show people and train people on how to take back control of their lives and their governments. It's not just going to happen by reading books. It's not going to just happen by knowing about these things. You have to have a strategy to come to power, the same way as the advocates of collectivism have not just sat around in study groups and talked about it and read books about it. They got together a long time ago under the direction of Cecil Rhodes, who says, all right, fellas, here is the plan, here is the structure, here is what we're going to do, step 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, to come to power so we can control the governments and the financial systems and the media and the educational systems of the world. He had a plan, And so we feel in Freedom Force that without a plan, it doesn't make any difference what we know. Nothing is going to change. So that's what Freedom Force is all about, and the address for that one is freedomforceinternational.org. Org for organization.
Right. Freedomforceinternational.org.
Yes.
Well, then Edwards is talking about the fact that as you begin looking into this whole incredible capitalist conspiracy, and incidentally, that's the title of the video. Is that available in DVD too?
Yes, it is in DVD.
All right, so you can get it either in DVD or in video, and we are going to be offering that because I think it's so important. But as you begin to study this, you find out that this has to do with money. It has to do with banking. And how it always seems that the people who are really pushing this are fabulously wealthy people who are really pushing this whole collectivist idea. So you pick the story up from there, Ed.
Well, yes, they're fabulously wealthy. And now we're going to touch back on a topic that we mentioned early in the program, which is that the fact that someone is fabulously wealthy doesn't necessarily mean that they're free enterprise, competitive capitalists. In fact, we find that in today's world, most of the wealthy people have not made their money through free enterprise competition, but they've made it through advantaged position in the marketplace as a result of legislation given to them because of their lobbying efforts and because of their control of politicians. It used to be that a man would excel in business because of his business expertise or his production expertise. Now it seems, if you just look at the heads of corporations, the biggest corporations, to excel in business today means to have contacts in government and to swing government contracts and to have the ability to call your congressman or your senator and say, look, we want this bill because it's going to increase our profits. It's not done through competition anymore. And that all started to change with the rise of the Rockefellers and what we now call the robber baron period of American history. A lot of these fellows, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, and others, they did rise up through the American industrial system through competitive practices and producing better products at cheaper prices and so forth. But it soon dawned on them along the way that the best way to do that was to create monopolies and cartels and to eliminate competition. Once they got to the top, they didn't want anybody else climbing to the top over them by competitive means. And so they went to work early on to try and bring government into their circles. They made partnerships between government and their cartels, and the Federal Reserve System, by the way, is a classic example of a cartel that was enshrined in law. Well, the Federal Reserve System was merely a cartel contract between all the banks. They wanted to control the banking system and keep competition under control, and so they brought the government into it and made their cartel agreement law. So now everybody had to comply with the cartel agreement or they would go to jail. You know, that's how that works. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that the wealthiest people in the world today have not made their money through free enterprise. They've made it through political contacts and political power and political influence. So the collectivists, in other words, are the wealthiest people in the world. The individuals who are trying out there to compete and to produce and do it fair and square are getting squashed by the monopolists and the cartelists working hand in hand with the government. So it's a complete switch around from what we learn in school. And it makes me very sad when I hear people say, well, it's the corporations that are the problem in the world today. And therefore, what we need is more government control. They don't realize that the corporations have become the government. You see, there's a partnership between them, so that it's impossible to tell the difference between them anymore.
And I think a beautiful example of that is the oil companies and the environmental movement.
Yes.
The oil companies created the environmental movement to pass laws that could keep them from having competition. Of course, supposedly we're supposed to believe that the oil companies are being fought by the environmental movement, and I'm sure there are a lot of good people out in the environmental movement. We just don't see how it really works. But the truth of the matter is, of course, they won't allow the building of oil refineries, which means that if you have an oil refinery now, why, you've just got to an automatic piggy bank and a manufacturer's money. You don't have to worry. Because nobody's going to be able to build oil refineries to compete with you.
That's right. Everything's status quo, and the big boys remain the big boys. And you've got to have the gasoline anyway, so you'll pay any price for it. So that's how that works.
And, of course, you do the same thing. You do away with nuclear power. You limit the development of nuclear power. So people have to either use oil or they have to use coal, which you control. And of course, then, of course, you scream about the dangers of emissions. And so then we pass a global warming thing. But this is really not going to influence the people who are manufacturing oil, because we're so dependent upon oil. But what this will do is, of course, perpetuate their monopoly, because nobody's going to be able to go into this business, because it's all tied up. They have created the cartels, and the average environmentalist, the average individual, really doesn't understand how the games are played. You couldn't go out and try to drill for oil. You might have the greatest oil field in your backyard.
I got to tell you a little story on that, Stan. About 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to put a little bit of my savings into an oil well, a small oil field that had been developed here in California. I said, boy, this looks good. Price of oil is going up. We need oil. America needs oil. And where else could I better put my money? Well, it's a great little oil field, but the environmentalists are all over it, man. There's no way they're going to get that rig to pump any oil out of the ground. So it's a perfect little microcosmic view of what you're talking about here. Here we could solve the oil crisis in the world with our little oil well, right? Or many of us together, of course, but there's no way that the environmentalists are going to allow us to pump any oil.
And that's why the oil companies created the environmental movement, and most people have no idea at all how this game is played.
Yeah, well, I'd like to return to this question of capitalism again, because I think that is such a critical issue, Stan.
Go right ahead.
You know, there are really, well, the words have, there are no good definitions of these words. The word capitalist, for example, they mean different things to different people. I'd like to suggest that there are really two kinds of capitalists. I mean, everybody is a capitalist to a certain extent. If you have money in your pocket, you've got capital. And that's maybe not a classical definition of capital. A capitalist probably is one who puts his money into production of tools and that sort of thing. But everybody is a capitalist in terms of having capital. It's just a question of who owns and who controls that capital. In communist countries or socialist countries, whatever they want to call them, they say, well, the capital is owned by the people. Sure. Just if you're a person in one of those countries and you own the oil reserves, for example, of the country, you just try and sell your share someday. You know, you can't sell it. You don't own it. But they trick people. Say, but it's owned by the people, which means it's owned by the government, which doesn't even mean that. It's owned by the people who run the government from behind the scenes. Well, so there are two kinds of capitalists. There are the free enterprise capitalists, and there are the monopoly capitalists. But everybody's a capitalist. The free enterprise capitalists are the ones who created this country, who made it great. They were out there, didn't want any special favors of government. They just wanted to see who could outproduce and outperform, make the best product and service for the lowest price. The monopoly capitalists, of course, came along at the turn of the last century, and they started to pass laws to preserve their monopolies and their cartels, and now the whole ball game changed. And so we got the kids coming out of school today, and I don't mean to put them down, because I came out of school as a kid the same way. I actually thought that capitalism was the problem. And I didn't know what capitalism was. And I thought, yeah, what we need is more government to restrict those big, mean, selfish capitalists. And now I realize, years later, that that's exactly what those big, mean, selfish capitalists wanted all along, is to have government to pass laws to regulate the industries in the name of helping the people. The people are saying, hurrah, we're going to solve this problem. We're going to put those corporations in their place. But meanwhile, it's the corporations from behind the scenes that are actually writing the laws. And the best example, of course, I'll come back to the freedom, back to the Federal Reserve Act, because that was written by the banks themselves, and it was sold to the American people as a means of breaking the grip of the money trust, getting rid of those big corporations on Wall Street and their control over the monetary system. We're going to pass the Federal Reserve Act and put control of the money into the hands of the people. That was the message. That was the slogan. That was the deception. And now we find out that, hey, that bill was actually written by the heads of those banking corporations, and it was just to preserve and perpetuate their power, not to restrict it.
In fact, Ed has written a book called The Creature of Jekyll Island, which we do carry, and we think that is founded. It is really the finest book on this subject because it really explains to you how money is created, how the whole system works. And I mean, what most people don't understand, what I really didn't understand until I read that book, is that our money is all based upon debt. And if you paid off all the debt, there wouldn't be any money left. It's the most incredible scam I've ever heard of. The fractional reserve system is a vehicle by which the banks create money out of nothing and then have the audacity to charge us interest on it. And this is going on all over the world.
Well, that's it. All of a sudden we're in banking again, is my favorite topic. The banks have been very slow to develop this, well, you called it a scam, and I would certainly agree with that. They've been slow to develop that over the centuries. This is not something that that just happened. And when you see how well-oiled the mechanism is, you have to stand back in awe and just say, my gosh, this is a work of genius. Even though it's totally immoral and totally a scam, and it's a means of enslaving people to hidden masters without them even knowing it, but you just have to say, wow, this is a brilliant mechanism. Kind of reminds me, I don't know who invented double entry accounting, you know, with debits and credits, but when you work with those systems, you think, wow, whoever dreamed this up? This is amazing. This is wonderful. But the banking system is 100 times more complex and more hard to fathom at first than double entry accounting.
It really is. And of course, the thing is that this was really the means by which these people, this small group of people, were able to gain the money to buy the politicians, to buy the newspapers, to buy the industries, to buy, really to buy America, to obtain the wealth of this country. And a very small group of people control it. And most of these people tie into the Council on Foreign Relations. Not all, but the vast majority of them do.
Well, that's true, Stan. And as you were saying that, my mind flashed back to a correspondence I just had recently with one of our subscribers that wanted to take issue with me on the fact that we could take back America if we could just reestablish a sound monetary system. And of course they were correct in my opinion in focusing on the importance of the monetary system in this puzzle, but to say that that is the only thing that needs to be done, I thought was a missing the mark by quite a distance. And it had to do with the American Liberty Dollar. I think many of your listeners may be familiar with it, but basically the American Liberty Dollar is a privately issued currency that is totally backed by gold and silver. I think it's a wonderful concept, and it's privately issued, which raises a question in the minds of many people at first. Well, how can you have a privately issued money? Doesn't that have to be issued by government? And the answer is no, it doesn't have to be at all. As a matter of fact, most of the sound currencies of history have started off as privately issued money, and it's when they are taken over by government that the problems start to work their way in, because only government has the power to force you to accept the money. Privately issued money will rise and fall on the basis of its own merit. If it has intrinsic value, people will accept it. If it has a reputation of not being backed or being partially backed or fraudulently managed, why, people will stop accepting it. But when you get money issued by the government, they pass legal tender laws, as they're called, which means that you have to accept the money regardless, or you go to jail. So it's when money is issued by governments that you begin to have problems with it. Well, this American Liberty Dollar is a privately issued monetary system, and I've always supported it. And but recently they've gotten into trouble with the Mint. The Mint has sent out a lot of press releases and threatening notices to this group saying that they are violating the law, that they're basically pretending to have money when in fact they don't. And I hear your theme music coming up there in the background, so maybe I ought to save the rest of this for after the break. Or
well,
how does this
fine,
work?
You just hang on there. Well, I guess this evening has been G. Edward Griffin, who's certainly one of the giants in this whole conservative movement. A conservative movement, liberal movement, call it what you will, a movement to try to preserve America. And so I really hope that you want to certainly go to his website. And what was that website one more time, Ed?
Yes, well, the one with the organizational force behind it is www.freedomforceinternational.org.
FreedomForceInternational.org, and we'll be talking more with Ed during this next hour here and developing these ideas. Well, Ed, go ahead and just tell that story about the Liberty Dollar.
Well, yes, and so all of a sudden the American Liberty Dollar is having a lot of difficulty trying to survive. It's not that they're being threatened directly at the moment, but people are backing away from it because they're thinking, oh my goodness, the government is saying this is illegal and so forth. And so the person to whom I'm referring had always said, we're going to just solve this problem by putting a sound monetary system into circulation. And so I had to write back and say, look, your point is well taken, but see what just happened with the American Liberty Dollar. If we just focus on a sound currency, as long as the government still has control over the raw power of the police and the military, and as long as the government still has absolute control over the informational systems of the nation, in other words, are able to control public opinion, then all they have to do is, anytime a sound monetary system becomes a little bit of a problem, all they have to do is demonize it in the press, and then say they have broken the law, and then send out the SWAT teams and take them out. So you're not going to solve the problem simply by trying to put back a sound monetary system. As important as that is, you have to look at the whole picture and realize that this evil force, I'll call it the evil empire, is based on three pillars, or three legs on the stool. One is the monetary system. The other is the control over the coercive elements of government, meaning the police and the military, and the third is the control over public opinion, to get the public to go along with whatever they want to do. So any plan that doesn't recognize the importance of all three is a plan that, in my opinion, is going to fail. And that's the reason that Freedom Force was created, because it focuses on all three of those elements.
And I think that's really absolutely true. There's no easy solution for this. People just say, oh, if we could just do this. Well, this is really a lifetime of work. Ed's been at it for a lifetime, and so have I. But we've got to get the American people to understand what is at stake. And we've got to get the American people on our side to value freedom more than they value all the comforts of our contemporary society. But it may be the best thing in the world that will happen if suddenly something were to happen to the stability of our currency. I think it's about to happen. I think we're at the verge of some catastrophic and cataclysmic changes. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the first hour here of Radio Liberty right on this station. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and what a unique opportunity we have to reach almost 60 different outlets every single week. By the miracle of Internet, shortwave, satellite, we're on three or four satellites, and then different radio stations. Some of the stations only hear us half an hour a week, and some of them have to hear us every day. But if we could get people the truth, eventually they begin to believe. In fact, how often I've had people say, you know, I used to think you were crazy, Then I was afraid that you weren't. Now I'm convinced you're right, and everybody else thinks that I'm crazy. And I've heard this same thing from people who've listened. The truth, though, is very, very obvious eventually, and it's logical. And so our major objective is to reach people. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, it's very, very simple. You just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Talk to Mary there, or who's ever answering the telephone, and you can learn how to join the Radio Liberty family and get our certainly our monthly four tapes. We call them the tapes of the month, either tapes or CDs, and or certainly get our newsletter, or just get the newsletter. But we want you to get the information you're not going to get elsewhere. Now, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can, of course, listen to us on the Internet there. 3 hours live every day. You can listen to the archive programs. We keep them up there for about 6 weeks. You can listen to the MP3 programs and pull them down onto your various electronic devices, and that's why they're there, so that you can utilize them. You have our permission to copy any of the programs we post up on the board, or really anything that we ourselves produce. Now, if somebody else produces it, why, we can't give you that permission. But if we produce it, why, we want you to get it, we want you to copy it, we want you to distribute it, we want you to pull down our newsletters, and you go back, they're listed, going back to the late 1990s, and of course, copy those newsletters and get them out, because most of them are just as apropos today as they were when they were written. So the website is radioliberty.com, that's radioliberty.com. If you're interested in this subject, I found it, you can Google in, for instance, I want to know what I wrote about Marilyn Ferguson and the Aquarian conspiracy. So a trick you can use is simply type in Radio Liberty and Marilyn Ferguson. They'll actually take you right to the newsletter where we wrote about her and quoted her, where she talks about this vast conspiracy that is there, that of course has broken with Western civilization. Has actually broken all traditions. It's something new. And, of course, it really is. And you can't understand so much of what's going on unless you understand what Marilyn Ferguson has written, because she's written from the other side. But, so, of course, there's so much up there. And but if you want to get a subject, you know I've written on it, just Google it in along with Radio Liberty. A very, very convenient way of having them do the research for you, and it's there on the website. So then, of course, we hope you'll read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It will give you insight into the big picture, which, of course, we pull in everything we've talked about and so much more, to begin to put these things into their perspective from a not only a political and ideological, but from a spiritual perspective, because, indeed, in many respects, we're fighting a spiritual battle on a political, ideological, cultural, economic battlefield. And if you don't understand the spiritual forces that energizes these people, and if you read Professor Quigley's book, he will repeatedly tell you what their objective is. They want to bring the kingdom of God to earth themselves. They want to bring the kingdom of God to earth. And you have to understand what sort of insanity would it be that any of us think that we can create the kingdom of God? Well, you have to understand what motivates these people. And Brotherhood of Darkness is an excellent place to start, and so many of the items that we have there. Anyway, the website, radioliberty.com, the telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And our special guest for this hour is G. Edward Griffin. He's written a number of books, The Fearful Master, which, of course, is still a classic. We actually have an Amazon.com website, and it's amazing how often we get requests for copies. We had a fair supply. We were just about out of them. But one of the best sellers that we have is his book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. It is a classic, and, of course, it's recommended by people all across the country who really are trying to help people to understand how the monetary system fits together. Now, of course, Ed has all sorts of great audio tapes, and he has all sorts of great videos, many of which he's produced at great expense and a great deal of time. And certainly one of my favorites is The Capitalist Conspiracy. And another one, of course, is his interview with Norman Dodd, who I had an opportunity to interview, but I never got a chance to put it into film form. But Ed has an interview with Norman Dodd that who has actually been the counsel in charge of research for the Reese Committee that investigated the great tax exempt foundations back in 1953 and 1954. And, of course, discovered that these great tax exempt foundations were intent upon so changing life in America that one day we could be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. In fact, that's what Rowan Gaither tells him, and you'll actually hear that on the in the video. Or, of course, we have my interview. Actually, I did at least get my interview with Norman Dodd on tape, but you can hear that in the video, and I think we'll be carrying that as well. What do you call that interview with Norman Dodd, Ed?
I call it The Hidden Agenda.
The Hidden Agenda. Of course, that's a great title. Well, let's talk. Where should we go this next hour?
Well, I was thinking about our major topic, the capitalist conspiracy, and the fact that people have a very befuddled mental definition of the word capitalist, and that it doesn't really tell us very much. And we were talking about the fact that collectivism is really the ideology that we need to be worried about, not communism or fascism or Nazism or socialism, because those are all variants of collectivism. And that made me think, Stan, when I did research for my book on cancer, which of course is close to your heart too, I was dragged into a piece of history I didn't want to know about. And that was the connection between the pharmaceutical industry and the IG Farben cartel in Nazi Germany. And when I say I was dragged into that, maybe that would be an interesting story to your listeners. I was researching all of the data, the scientific data, about the control for cancer that could be found in non-drug therapies and in Laetril and amygdalin and things found in nature. And I was all aflame with the scientific side of this story. And at the time, I was very close to Dr. John Richardson, who was an MD in the San Francisco area, and I think you were very close to him too, who was using this substance in the treatment of his cancer patients. And I was drawing a lot of information from him and his clinic and from the discoverer of vitamin B17, who was Dr. Ernst T. Krebs, Jr. So all of that was very well and good. I was on the scientific tack. But Dr. John's assistant was Ralph Bowman, and he kept giving me books and information about the Nazi cartel and the pharmaceutical connection in Germany, and I kept saying, yeah, Ralph, that's fine, that's interesting, but it has nothing to do with cancer, does it? And he said, oh, yes, it does. And reluctantly, I was dragged into it, and finally, when I just said, okay, I'm going to see what's here, I was amazed, and I found that, pertaining to our topic here tonight, that the Nazi regime was actually financed to a large extent from Wall Street in New York.
And of course, the thing is, of course, I think the next thing we'll be talking about, perhaps when we get back, is the fact there's been a cover-up of effective treatments for cancer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest at G. Edward Griffin. Ed, go ahead and pick the story up.
Yes, well, that was kind of an introduction, a lengthy introduction to the subject. That's when I began to realize that my understanding of these words, fascism, Nazism, communism, was quite flawed. Because I had been taught in school that fascism, Nazism, and what we had over there in Germany under Adolf Hitler, was a system in which the corporation's industry was controlled by government. And the general image was that the corporate interests cooperated with the government, and then weren't they sorry afterwards because the government wound up controlling them, taking them over, and running them. And that they made a big mistake. That's kind of how I learned it. Now I got back into it with my own original research, reading original documents from the people themselves, the industrialists inside Germany at the time who were doing it, and I got an entirely different picture. It turns out that it was the industrialists in Germany, especially clustered around the IG Farben cartel, which was involving pharmaceuticals and munitions and that kind of thing. Those are the people who supported Hitler and literally took over the government and controlled the government. It was the other way around from how I had been taught. I was taught that the government controlled the industry. I discovered it was industry that controlled the government. And wow, and from that point forward, I began to see things in a different light. And of course, when you look at what's happening in the United States today, it's a very close parallel. We get the general impression that we've got to get government laws passed, more and more laws passed, to control industry, to control those big corporations. And if you look who's pushing for those laws, who's drafting the legislation and urging congressmen to pass them, it's the corporations themselves. And it's because the corporations now know, with their great financial influence, and including the banking influence, they control the government. And they're getting the government to pass laws that they want in place in order to preserve their profit and eliminate competition. So that was a long way to get into it, but I wanted to use the Nazi example to show that collectivism is the same everywhere, whether it's called communism, fascism, Nazism, or neoconservatism. I don't care what name you want to give it. It's, once you peel off the label and look underneath, you find that same totalitarian concept.
And it is it there, it is, of course, it permeates every aspect of our society. And, of course, today, of course, now that we have this threat of Osama bin Laden living in a cave, we've got to give up our freedom. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is G. Edward Griffin. And Ed is simply pointing out that it's not that that Hitler, you know, used the capitalists once he got into power. You know, then of course he took over their holdings. And no, it was that the capitalists put Adolf Hitler in power and put Mussolini in power, and they were always the force behind them. But we can't tell the American people that. And there is something inherently wrong with certain of our major corporations, both the German corporations, IG Farben, and even many of the great American corporations, General Motors and Ford, who all during the Second World War were producing the war materials for Germany. They were then being utilized put the Wehrmacht, Hitler's military, on wheels, and were carrying the German soldiers to Normandy, where they would then, of course, be used to kill the American soldiers. And you get into the background of trading with the enemy, Charles Higham's book, why you find out that even during the Second World War, when our boys were dying, you know, on the battlements there in Normandy, that, of course, American corporations were trading, banks were trading with Adolf Hitler through Sweden, and all during the Second World War. Certainly our oil companies and elsewhere were trading with the enemy, and most Americans had no idea what was going on.
Well, that's the story that I got tricked into, Stan, and as I said earlier, I really didn't want to know all of that, because I thought it was, first of all, it sounded kind of kooky at first, and secondly, I thought it made no difference on the cancer story, but it did make a big difference in the cancer story, because once I realized that this was the case, then that led me inexorably to examine how these cartels, the pharmaceutical cartels, were able to influence the healthcare industry and the medical establishment, and how through that influence they were able to determine which therapies were acceptable and which were not. And lo and behold, you find out that the whole medical field today is skewed in the direction of pharmaceutical drugs, and that is not an accident. That was well thought through, and it was done through philanthropy, supposedly, the donations of large amounts of money through tax-exempt foundations, which were controlled by the very people we're talking about, led to university research, led to grants to universities to create medical centers, all of which were staffed by people who were very favorable to the pharmaceutical industry, because that's where the money came from. So these people came along to look after their money, and the doctors that went to those schools got trained in pharmaceuticals, the research was focused on pharmaceuticals, and everything else was pushed aside. And so now, when you go to your doctor's office, as you know, Stan, and I don't care what you've got, chances are you're going to walk out of there with a prescription, because that's what he's been trained to do.
Yeah, I mean, to that, and even, Chris, from the doctor's point of view, if you don't give a prescription, sometimes people sort of feel cheated.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the other hand, if the doctor were to say, well, why don't we just wait and see what's going to happen? The patient's going to say, I'm going to go to a doctor who'll treat me. I want something done. And they don't understand that sometimes you're better off just to wait and see, or sometimes there are natural remedies that will get you well ever so much more quickly and efficiently and not produce all the complications.
Right.
But, of course, your book, A World Without Cancer, really got into the background of Laetrile. And what's really so interesting is my January newsletter, half of that is something called the Fitzgerald Report, which was a report that was actually entered into the congressional record in 1953, and never seen since then. I had a gentleman who sent me a check for $50, and he said, get me a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. I've been trying to get this for months. I went to my library. I know what it would put in the congressional record. My library can't give me a copy. They wrote to 10 other libraries. None of them would send a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. Why don't you get that? Well, gee, for $50, I think I'll just go up on the web and pull it down for them. And I found all sorts of references on the Internet to the Fitzgerald Report, but I couldn't find any record of it. In other words, I couldn't get the report itself. Everybody said what a great and important report it was. So then I caught, well, the National Health Federation, the largest, you know, private health organization in the United States, with, I don't know, 20, 30,000 members. Surely they'll have a copy of the Fitzgerald Report. I went to them, and they said, you know, we tried for years to get a copy of the Fitzgerald Report, and we could never get a copy of it, you know, and we tried. We did everything we could. Well, eventually I was able to get a copy, and that's half of my newsletter. And it's basically the story that you tell in your book, A World Without Cancer, and that is that in 1953, they did a government investigation. It was one of the Interstate Commerce Committee, I think, of the Senate, and they actually found out that there was an organized effort to suppress Laetrile, and the Gerson diet, and Dr. Hoxie's treatment, effective treatments for cancer, and they were certainly as effective as certainly the chemotherapy and radiation, but the trouble was you couldn't patent them, you couldn't make a big profit on them, and of course they were far more effective and far less taxing and destructive to the individual. So that's probably what you found when you were looking at the Laetrile, wasn't it?
That's exactly what I found, yes, and they keep coming back over and over again. The fact that the industrial groups that are doing this, they may be called capitalists in the sense that they have capital, but they're certainly not free enterprise capitalists. They are monopoly capitalists. And that's the theme of the show tonight, that there's a big difference between having a lot of money and being a free enterprise advocate.
And, of course, the thing is, what they did is they used the power of government to stop the competition. And, of course, there was another agenda which most people find it difficult to believe. And that there really are... that exact remark. People are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. In 1903, 3% of the American people contracted cancer and died of it. Today, 50% of the American people contract cancer and die of it, and that's not accidental. Well, then why don't you pick up the story, and would you like to talk about what you discovered there, or would you like to, where would you like to go?
Well, that's a good question. We're splashing around, as we said. I keep trying to come back to the theme of the capitalist conspiracy.
Well, you go wherever you'd like to, and I'll just be quiet here.
You know, I think that's such an important one, and I've mentioned the word several times tonight, this word collectivism, and it may be that that's foreign to the ears of some listeners. I've said several times that fascism, communism, Nazism, socialism, even neoconservatism and all those things are meaningless words, that when you peel off the labels of those words and look underneath, you always find the same essence, the same ideology, which is collectivism. And so that's a pretty rich topic there. I think we may have discussed this on your program sometime in the past. I think it bears repeating, Stan. As I see it, there are only two possible ideological or political views that are extant in the Western world today. And it's collectivism versus individualism. You've got to choose one or the other, unless you're brain dead and you don't care or don't have any views or whatever. But if you're interested in these topics and you want to know what is the best political system or social system, you've either got to sign on to collectivism or you sign on to individualism. And unfortunately, most people don't even know what those words mean. So how are they going to sign on to anything? So maybe I could take just a moment and give a brief overview. I'll talk about collectivism first. And just knowing that individualism is the opposite. No matter what I say about collectivism, individualism will be the opposite. The first thing about individualism, perhaps the most important thing is, collectivism, whatever I said. The most important thing about collectivism is to know that collectivists believe that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual or the minority must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. And that's usually how it's expressed, or the greater good of society. Or, in a full-blown totalitarian system, they would say the greater good of the state. It all adds up to the same thing, the greater good of the greater number. And I was taught that in school. It made a lot of sense to me. I thought, well, sure, this is a democracy, isn't it? And, of course, there's one of those other words that needs to be defined, but, you know, how are you going to, if you have to choose between the majority and the minority, you better go with the majority. So that's the basis. Now, the individualist says, whoa, wait a minute, what is this greater good of the group? What's this group business? What is a group? And when you think about it, Stan, there's no such thing as a group. It's a word concept. It's an abstraction. It's a concept for many individuals. But the group by itself does not exist. It's only this abstraction. The same as the word forest. There's no such thing as a forest. You can't touch a forest. You can touch trees, but you can't touch a forest. It's an abstraction for the concept of many trees. And so when you sacrifice an individual, which is real, for an abstract concept of group, which is not real, you've made a huge mistake. What you're going to wind up doing in the long run is you're going to be sacrificing the group anyway, whatever that means, in terms of many individuals. And usually it means that someone who will declare himself as the ruler will decide what is in the best interest of the group. And you're right back to a pure dictatorship, only with fancy trappings and rationale to support it.
And of course it's so important people understand that, you know, America was built upon the individual. And the individual under God, and our rights came from God. We seem to have forgotten that. Well, go ahead and pick the story up there, Ed.
Well, that was a very short overview of that. I heard your music start, so I kind of galloped along to get to the end of it. But anyway, you understand the point there. Another difference between individualists and collectivists is that collectivists believe that rights, human rights, come from the state. And individualists believe that rights are intrinsic to the human being and that we're born with them. It's the difference between software and hardware. If you take a look at all of the documents of the collectivist regimes of history, all of them, whether it's the Soviet Constitution or the laws and the Constitution under Adolf Hitler and in fascist Italy, you take a look at the draft covenant of human rights that is produced by the United Nations, all of these collectivist documents, you will find it said very plainly that rights are granted by the state. Now, in the United States Constitution, you have just the opposite. It says that the purpose of government is to protect the rights of the individual, and not to grant them, but to protect them, and that's just 180 degrees out of sync. Now, the problem with granting rights by, or assuming that rights can be granted by the state, is that in that case, the state could also take them away. And so you have this little game that they play. You find it in the Soviet Constitution. You certainly find it in the UN Draft Covenant of Human Rights, where they say, for example, all people are guaranteed the right to freedom of speech. It's a very important right. Everybody has the right to freedom of speech. And then if you read on, it says, except when provided by law. Wow. Nobody reads on. All they read is that, oh, we got the right to freedom of speech. But then if they read the rest of it, except as provided by law, which means until they decide to take away that right, all they have to do is just pass a law, and you've lost them. You see, if the state can grant you a right, it can take away your right. So there's a big difference right there between individualism and collectivism. Another one is very important, and that is that most common people today, even though they sign on to collectivism because they're tricked into it, they all want the same things that individualists want. We all want good things for our fellow human beings. We want honesty. We want justice. We want security. We want everybody to be happy and healthy. You know, all the good things. We all want that. The disagreement comes over how to achieve them. The collectivist says, if there's something that's worthy in society, then by golly, we're not going to give anybody any choice. We're going to force them to do what is right, because we know it's right for, it's good for them. So we who are infinitely wise, and we who are in charge, we will pass a law, and we're going to force everybody to do what we know is right for them. So always the collectivist is oppressing people in the name of helping people. I know you don't like this. This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you, a parent says to the child. Well, the collectivist has the same attitude when they're in charge of government. And you may not like this, but it's for your own good. And so they'll pass laws for the benefit of society, supposedly, and they're going to force everybody to do exactly what it has been predetermined to do. For example, let's say, before I forget the analogy, the individualist says, no, you can have freedom of choice to do these things, and we hope you will do them, and we'll convince you to do them, we'll show you by good example, but we're not going to coerce you to
hold that thought right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is G. Edward Griffin, and we're talking about this whole difference between the collectivist and the individualist. And he was pointing out that the collectivist says, look, we know what's best for you, and we want to protect you from doing the wrong thing. We want a better society, so we're going to pass a law, and we're going to force you to do it our way.
Right.
Now, but the individualist says, well, we agree with you, there's a problem, but we want, of course, give people, or at least some local form of government rather than a centralized form of government, the ability to accomplish the same goal. It's like a medical care, you know. Do we want medical care controlled from Washington, D.C., where every government provides mediocre or non-existent care for everybody? Or would we rather have the local community have a county hospital as we used to, where, of course, through the good intentions of the people and through the local tax money, where we were able to provide care for those people who were indigent, or partial pay for those who were indigent? Some people couldn't pay at all. Some people could pay part. nobody went off without medical care until the government came in to help us. So pick the story up there, Ed.
Yeah, I think a classic example is the silly seatbelt law. Now, everybody knows that seatbelts are a good idea. That's not the issue. Individualists and collectivists both agree. Seatbelts are great. You ought to wear seatbelts. It saves lives. And so the collectivist says, okay, since it's a good idea, let's have a law. And we're going to force everybody to do what is right, or else we're going to put them in jail. So they immediately turn to coercion. No matter what is to be desired in society, if you don't like somebody throwing a cigarette out the window, for example, and I don't like that either, the collectivist says, ah, there ought to be a law to prevent that. If you don't like somebody working on Sunday, there ought to be a law to prevent that, you see. That's the telltale sign of the collectivist mind. Whatever they think is good for society or for themselves, there ought to be a law. And so we have all these laws. Every day there's another law added to the books. Always for the benefit of society. One more law. Well, that's not so bad. This little law, we can live with that. And that one, we can live with that. But at the end of 50 years or 100 years, a new law every day, or 20 new laws every day, we are living in a totalitarian system. And we brought it on ourselves. The individualist, on the other hand, says, sure, we don't want people throwing cigarettes out the window. We don't want people driving without seatbelts, but we're not going to coerce them to do so. We're going to show them by good example. We're going to maybe dig into our pocket and put on educational campaigns and all of that, but we're not going to throw people in jail because we believe in freedom of choice. And so there's another very clear distinction between a collectivist and an individualist. And perhaps another one we could talk about, Stan, is the fact that collectivists believe in treating different classes of people differently. They don't believe in equality under law, whereas individualists believe in true equality under law, where everybody is treated exactly the same, regardless of who they are or what class they belong to. Now, the collectivist says, no, we can't have that because we have to rearrange society. We are social engineers. We are smart. We know how society can and should be improved. And so we're going to restructure society. We can't do that by treating everybody the same. We have to redivide the wealth, for example. We have to take money away from some people that have too much and give it to others who have too little. Or we have to make special provisions for those who have, let's say, a physical disability. We have a special provision for somebody who's over a certain age, or we have a special provision for somebody who's a certain gender or a certain race or a certain religion. Whatever it is, we're going to restructure society, and we're going to benefit some members of the group at the expense of other members of the group because, of course, it's for the greater good of the greater number. We're back to that again. Whereas the individualist believes that, hey, no hanky-panky, everybody's exactly the same. And there again, you can find that difference all over the map. I would guess that if we looked at all the rules and the laws that are on the books today, probably about 98% of them treat different classes of people differently. There is no such thing as equality under law under a collectivist system. And so there's another very important distinction. And finally, the last one we might talk about is that there are sometimes certain gray areas where you're not sure whether it should be one way or the other. And I think the lesson of history is that whenever there's doubt, you should always go in the direction of safety, conservative. In other words, the less government you have, the better off you are. That government which governs least governs best.
Yeah, because I always love to say liberty and limited government is synonymous. Tyranny and total government is synonymous. Which would you rather have, limited government or total government? Which way are we headed? Well, we're headed towards government, total government over every aspect of our lives. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is G. Edward Griffin. Ed, right ahead. Pick up that story. I think this is so pivotal to understanding the difference between collectivism and individualism. And of course, collectivism always ends up with tyranny. Individualism ends up with liberty.
Well, I just went through the five basic provisions that can be used to tell whether a policy is collectivist or individualist. Those are embodied in what we call in Freedom Force, we call it the Creed of Freedom, and we touch on all five of those. And the people who come into our movement, Stan, all understand this, they internalize it, and they actually say, yes, we sign this creed, this we believe. And it's a very powerful document, I would say. If anybody wants to read our Creed of Freedom, they can come to our freedomforceinternational.org site and click on the main page that says the Creed of Freedom, and you can read it, and plus a lot more explanation to validate it historically and logically.
And I think people have to understand the basic ideas upon which freedom is based. And the difference between the liberal idea, which says, let government first determine what's best for you. We need government. We can't have anarchy. We've got to have a government. I mean, who would take care of the poor if it wasn't for government? Who would provide housing for the poor? Who would provide health care for the poor? Do you want people to die because there's no health care for them?
Well, that's my point, Stan. We all agree on those things, but the question is how?
Absolutely.
How? You know, you take the famous Marxist slogan, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Now, that's Marxism from top to bottom, and my question is, what's wrong with that? That's a wonderful statement of Christian charity, is it not? From each according to his ability, to each according to his need, what's wrong with that? And the answer is, there's nothing wrong with it, until you ask the question, how? Under collectivism, which would mean communism, fascism, Nazism, and so forth, the answer is, we're going to do it by force, by golly. We're going to have a government set up, and we're going to determine who has the ability and who has the need, and we're going to send in the police, and we're going to take the money from you, whether you want to give it or not, and we're going to give it to this person over here, whether he's worthy or not, but if he's got political influence, he's going to get it, and we're going to do it by coercion, you see. Whereas the individualist says, yeah, I believe, yes, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, but let's do it voluntarily, folks. And of course, the collectivist answers, yes, but not everybody will do it voluntarily. People will not respond to their charitable obligation. And the individualist answers, that's true, but which would you rather have, some people falling short or tyranny?
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ed has been making those very, very valid points, the difference between collectivism and individualism. Collectivism does everything by force. Individualism does everything by choice. And, of course, you can't have an individualist society unless you have moral people. It has been said, I think it was William Penn, who said, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And our society was made for a moral and religious people that wouldn't suffice for any other. Said John Adams, you cannot be free unless you have moral people. And I remember the slogan of the Birch Society, less government and more individual responsibility and a better world. And I believe that the idea put forward there, less government, more individual responsibility, and I always like to add morality and a better world. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for our guest this evening, who certainly is one of the most knowledgeable people in the country on this subject of freedom, because he's been fighting for it for well over, of course, 50 years now. Well, Ed, of course, Ed, one more time, would you like to get out those web pages so if we have new listeners, they'll know how to get to them?
The educational materials that we have for sale, our commercial site is called realityzone.com. It's easy to remember. Realityzone.com. We have over 100 items there, Stan. Mostly books, but a good number of videos and an audio series that we think is just great. We call it the Audio Archives. So that's realityzone.com. But the organizational site, and that's the place where I spend most of my time and effort trying to mobilize a counterforce against this rise of collectivism. We call that Freedom Force International. and that is the website. It's www.freedomforceinternational.org. Org, of course, stands for organization. There's a lot of material on that site, as you know, Stan. You could probably spend days on it, and of course, we don't expect anybody to do that right away. So we've organized it so that we go sort of from the general to the specific. We've got the major topics up front, and you can see what that's all about, and then you can drill down in any one of them as deeply as you wish to go. And we're very, very encouraged by this because, you know, I think this has been the missing piece all these years. You've mentioned several times that I've been in this fight and you've been in this fight for all these years. And that's certainly true. And it wasn't until just a few years ago when we formed Freedom Force International that I finally realized what the missing piece of the puzzle was. Why was it that even though the majority of the people of the United States did not want collectivism, they did not want this expansion of government around them, they didn't want this program or that program, and yet they were getting it anyway. They were writing letters to their congressmen. Didn't make any difference. They read books. Didn't make any difference. They went to seminars. Didn't make any difference. They went to fancy dinners and had speakers. Didn't make any difference. They signed petitions. Didn't make any difference. They went to rallies and held up their placards. Didn't make any difference. Why? Why? I kept saying to myself, we have all of these people, and yet it didn't make any difference. And it finally dawned on me. It didn't make any difference because none of our people were in positions of authority or power. We just didn't think that way. We just kept thinking that if you just knew something, that it would suddenly, that the problem would go away. If you could just get enough people to read and to understand, then somehow, magically, all of these people who were in charge would lose their positions of authority. And it doesn't work that way. That's what I began to re-examine the strategies that the collectivists have used successfully for the last century, literally, to come to power. How they put their people into positions of all the power centers of society. How come they're in charge of the political parties and the media centers? And how come their people are at the tops of universities and at the tops of church organizations and labor unions and so forth? How come? Was that just an accident? No, not at all. They had a strategy. They had a plan. They even had schools on how to do that. Meanwhile, we're out there reading books and sending petitions. And there was not a fair competition. Not a fair contest at all. So that's when Freedom Force was born, and that is the turnabout, and I think it's the missing piece of the puzzle, is that we must now come into positions of power and authority so that we can be leaders instead of petitioners.
And I think their slogan is, think globally, but act locally. Think
yes.
globally, but act locally, yes. and act. I mean, that was the important thing.
And act. And I have no problem thinking globally. There's nothing wrong with global. It's just, again, the question is, what kind of global? Are we going to have a global system based on individualism, in other words, freedom of choice? Or are we going to have a global system based on collectivism, which means coercion?
Amen to that. But the other thing was act. I mean, that was the thing.
Well, act. That's the point, of course.
Be involved.
Act. And getting involved, what does that mean? That means, let's take it one more step, that means not distributing literature. It means not just reading another book. It means not going to another meeting. It means getting out there where the people are, where the masses are, into the organizations to which they belong and becoming influential in those organizations. Don't expect people to come to your little study groups. That's not going to change anything. You go where they are. And that's what ACT means to them.
Amen. And you're absolutely right. Well, let's go to Ray, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Did you have a question or comment for our guest?
I do. If people like Bill Clinton are Rhodes Scholars, how do they pick these people? Do they pick the most intellectually brightest people from college, or how does that work?
That's a very, very good question.
I have a good general idea. Of course, I'm not privy to the specific selection process, but take Bill Clinton, for example. I think he was handpicked.
Yeah.
By his professors, and Quigley was undoubtedly, I think he probably was one of them.
Right.
So the professors are part of this chain, you see. They're part of that structure. They may be down pretty far, but they're part of a structure, and they're given invitations by mail to look for unusually bright students who are intellectually oriented toward the collectivist point of view. And then they submit candidates, and then they go to a review group, and then they're interviewed. And now I'm going to, I know that that's true, but now I'm going to go beyond what I know and tell you what I suspect. I think they, oh man, I shouldn't say this, but I think they also look for characteristics in the candidate which make them blackmailable, and or at least indicate that they're totally ruthless, because they need that quality as well.
Right, yeah, I think so. I believe so. I guess the only other thing I wanted to say was Adolf Hitler was not, he was not in the, that society, was he? He was more of a theosophist or a Satanist, actually.
Well, there's some reason to believe that many of them are in that category, although I'm not an expert on that.
Mm-hmm.
No, Adolf Hitler was not a member of, he was certainly not the in the Leninist group, and he was not in the Rhodesian group. He was in his own group.
Yeah, he was in his own group.
Yeah, he was in his own group, and had it not been extinguished in World War II, we would have had three competing groups out there.
Right.
There's some people even, Ray, who think that there still is the Nazi movement, at least that influence. Many of the Nazis, as you know, escaped to South America.
Right.
And many of them came right here to the United States. They're under Operation Paperclip.
And they're operating today under a different banner.
Right, absolutely.
They haven't had to change their views one bit.
They were brought into the Nassau program early on, in the 1950s, early on.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's it.
Thanks so very much.
Thanks so
much. Of course, let's go to Jack then, calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I wanted Edward G. Edward to tell me whether he's ever looked at how the government system is organized and functions as a municipal corporate trust under corporate trust law.
Now, are you acquainted with these concepts of the government operating under corporate trust law?
Yes, I am. As a matter of fact, I just wrote an essay on that and posted it to my website at Freedom Force. You may find it worthwhile. When you go to the website, look under the main heading called Issues, and you'll find it. And I won't go into it now because it's quite a lengthy answer to your question, but I will say that my view is probably not what you would expect. I don't believe that historically you can establish that the federal government today is operating as a corporation. But beyond that, my view would be it would make very little difference if it were or were not, because both a corporation and a constitution, a corporation charter, I should say, and a constitution are both written documents. They're both created by government. And they both outline the extent of the authorities and the geography, everything about the unit being created is just a paper document, whether you call it a charter or a constitution. And they're both created by government, and I think what you come out with at the bottom line is the unhappy question: so what? They can do anything under a constitutional form of government that they can do under a charter, a corporate charter, provided that the constitutional government is subverted, which it is. So I think we're spending a lot of time arguing over some technicality that in reality doesn't really make an awful lot of difference, although it's an interesting question, and it's almost a scholarly issue. But anyway, that's in a nutshell, that's my view, and I invite anyone who wants to read it. Perhaps you'll disagree with it, and I'd be happy to hear from you if you do. You'll find it on my website.
Okay, thanks very much, Jack. And our telephone again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, one of the biggest problems we have, Ed, and I'm sure you have run into this, is that people get into all these all the abstract considerations and discussions, and we spend all of our time arguing back and forth rather than attacking the enemy, where they are certainly the most vulnerable, and that is with the truth, these ideas of liberty, and getting our people in spokesmen into key positions where they will have a voice through the structure of society that's out there exists today.
That certainly
and
is.
I think your idea of joining their organizations into the Rotary and get into these various service clubs. And, you know, and just be a nice guy and then eventually begin bringing your ideas forward, but always be sure that you can explain them in a simple, logical manner.
Yes, and that doesn't mean that we're trying to infiltrate or take over these organizations. It means that we're supporting them. I mean, we're asking people to go into organizations that they have an affinity with and that they like and that they want to support. It's a means of getting the ideas of individualism out there into the mainstream. Instead of always being on the outside of the halls of power, looking in through the window and saying, please, those of you in there who make decisions, would you please listen to us and do what we request? Instead of doing that, we should get ourselves inside and let other people request us. You know, there's an old saying, you can't fight City Hall. And we reply, of course not, but you can become City Hall.
A point very, very well taken. And I think that it's so vitally important. People understand we're involved basically in a battle for the survival of Western civilization. And there really are people who don't believe in Western civilization, who would subvert it and destroy it, and they have an agenda. And we who advocate freedom of the individual certainly have another agenda, and I believe our agenda is better than theirs. The trouble is, they never teach this in colleges, and they would actually do everything they can to prevent anybody from getting a doctorate degree or teaching in a college who holds these values. And there are a few people out there with PhDs who have teaching positions and tenure who certainly espouse these positions. And actually, even though they have tenure, they'll actually viciously attack them or restrict them as far as their access to the students. The people on the other side really don't play fair, do they, Ed?
No, they don't believe in fair. You know, a really dedicated collectivist, and I'm not just talking about the guys like myself. When I came out of school, I just sort of said, yeah, you can have my vote. I'm talking about the dedicated ones at the top. They consider themselves to be in a state of war, literally. They have the war morality. And, you know, in times of war, there is only one immoral act, and that is to lose. Everything else is moral. And this is how these people operate, because they're trying to create this grand thing, this new world order, which they consider to be the highest morality of all. And it doesn't make any difference what you have to do to bring about this wonderful state. They're sure that no matter how many people have been lied to, how many people have been murdered, or whatever, that when the final history book is written, that their children and their grandchildren will sing their praises.
And, of course, they really do, at least according to Professor Quigley, intend to bring the kingdom of God to earth. And, actually, we've talked to other people who've been affiliated and read their literature, and they come up to the same conclusion. There's a scholar over in Switzerland we interviewed recently who has written a book on this basic topic, bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth. But, of course, I should say bring a kingdom of God to earth. But you have to have an awfully large ego to really think that you're going to be able to do that.
Yes, well, some of the classic writers of the collectivist mentality make no bones about it. H.G. Wells wrote about that at some length, you know. And he said that the state is the kingdom of God, that the state is the proper replacement for religion in the minds of the masses. And he said that is God, the state, the majority, in other words, you know. The greater good of the greater number. We're back to that. And he actually predicted the day would come when people would worship the state, as they then did various gods in their churches and synagogues and temples.
And even wrote a book about the open conspiracy.
Yes, and that's where he writes about this.
And, of course, everything is on a timetable. I mean, I could go back and write the things he was writing in the early 30s. And he talked about the Second World War. He even told him exactly the month it was going to begin. And then, of course, he goes on there to say that, you know, the third triad, the New World Order, and this comes from a book, I think it's called The Shape of Things to Come. The third triad, the New World Order, will come out of a conference in Basra in the 1880s, or 1888, something like that, 1988. Well, he was a little off on his timing, but certainly he was calling his attention to the fact that so much of this was going to evolve around what was going on in the Middle East sometime
well,
in that.
Stan, you know what I think the problem with you and me is? We read too many books.
Well, I'll tell you what I enjoy reading. It really gives us insight to understand what the people on the other side think and believe. Our guest this evening has been Z. Edward Griffin. And, of course, one more time, your website?
FreedomForceInternational.org is our organizational site, and the commercial site is RealityZone.com.
All right. All right, fine. Well, anyway, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's been G. Edward Griffin. Ed, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us, and then we'll let you go.
Oh.
But it's been a fascinating evening. I always enjoy having reminiscing and go over these same issues, because they're seminal to the battle in which we're engaged.
Well, let's see. How do I wrap this up? I think we need to look forward whenever we deal with a topic like this, which has some problems. Instead of looking backward, which we have to do, you don't know where you are, and you certainly don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. But now let's look forward. What are we going to do about this? You already know that I believe that the concepts embodied in Freedom Force International is the secret, is the missing key to success, is to take back the power centers of society, not just in the United States, but all around the world. It's a massive task. It's a massive undertaking. Many people would say, you can't get that done. That can't be done at all. And my reply is, but it has been done. Our collectivist opponents have done it. They did it brilliantly, but the thing we need to focus on is that it took them 100 years to do it. And people on our side don't have that kind of long view of history. They're impatient. They want it done by the next election. They say, don't talk to me about 100 years or 50 years or even 20 years. What are we going to do for the next election? Who are you going to vote for? So they got this little short-term mentality, and I can tell you those people are not going to solve the problem. We have to have the long view of history. What we are hoping to build may not happen in our lifetime. I don't believe it will, certainly not in my lifetime. And that at first that was depressing to me, because when I was younger, I used to think, just like I was saying a moment ago, let's get it done now. I want to get on with my life. I want to have fun and so forth. Let's solve this problem and move on. But as I matured in the battle, I realized, that's not the way it's done. We have to go back into the power centers of society and recapture them all around the world. We have to popularize and spread the creed of freedom so people can understand what they're fighting for, as well as what they're fighting against, because in the past people have always been anti this and anti that, but they've never been for anything except that vague word freedom. But they didn't know what freedom was. To many people, freedom is merely not being in jail. You ask them to define freedom and they can't. And so the look forward is very positive in my view. It's going to happen, Stan. We may have a dark day, a dark month, a dark year, a dark decade ahead of us. But at the end of that, the sun will shine if we do our work now. And if we think about not just ourselves, but our children and our grandchildren and their children and the future, it's a very optimistic view. And so I invite anybody that had that kind of a long view of history to come on board and check us out at Freedom Force.
And our guest has been G. Edward Griffin, and he's inviting people to come and check out Freedom Forum, and first, once again, that website, Ed?
It's freedomforceinternational.org.
God bless. Good night, and thanks so very much.
Thank you, Stan.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure on my part to have G. Edward Griffin, especially for a two-hour session, and of course, certainly one of the great giants in this whole movement to try to preserve the freedom of our nation for generations yet unborn. Well, of course, this is the time when I have to talk about my minor little effort, which is, of course, Radio Liberty, something we've put together with, of course, the help of our supporters, and I really believe with God's help, because I really don't take much credit for this. I mean, how many people out there do you know in the listening audience who had somebody else put in a radio station for them and build a studio and lay all the wires and put in the transmitters and the aerial, and I mean, that just doesn't happen in the real world, but it happened to me, and somebody built a radio station for us. And after all, when you're doing one radio program, you might as well do two. And if you're going to do two, it does not that much more work to do three or four. And then people would call and give us an opportunity to come onto the networks. And, of course, we had to pay for it. Very reasonable fees, at least to begin with. And, of course, that's how you get started. But eventually, of course, we've got to a point where we're almost self-sufficient. But what a unique opportunity to speak to people, not only this country, but throughout the world. And we have listeners all over the world listening to the miracle of shortwave, of the Internet, and of satellite. So if you'd like to be part of our team here at Radio Liberty, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 and join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Read Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope. Get the facts down so you can discuss them intelligently. And then, of course, join in this truly noble effort to try to save our country for generations yet unborn. And believe me, this is, in many ways, a thankless job. We may never see it accomplished during our lifetime, but I feel I'm called to do it, and I hope that you will as well, because we're truly involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. There are people on the other side who are motivated by evil, and when you understand that, so much of this makes sense, and of course, this is the only way you can really understand communism. This is the only way you can understand Nazism. This is the only way you can understand fascism. This is the only way you can understand what is going on in America today, as they've intentionally taken God and prayer, mention of God and prayer out of our schools. Why? Because they wanted to target the mind of the youth. I mean, the Supreme Court begins in session every day when the crier comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. How could the Supreme Court start talking about God and we can't mention God in our schools? Very simply, because they have decreed it. And it is because the Masons controlled the United States Supreme Court. Starting in 1941 and up to 1971 with majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. How could that have happened and you'd never heard of it? Because they control the media. You need to get our videos, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and our new video, or actually our DVDs, entitled Riddles in Stone. This is just coming out now, Riddles in Stone. You will be enthralled, amazed, and you'll be enlightened when you understand of the history of our nation's cattle and the dualism that is behind everything going on. Some people worshiping the God of heaven and the other people worshiping the God of this earth. And so our number 1-800-544-8927, the new video, DVD, you'll want to get Riddles in Stone. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.